This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rock Cash, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen by phone calling 716-748-0144, or if you have a smartphone or a computer, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to Station 2, and click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with calling questions for our guests, toll-free in the USA and Canada, 888-429-5471. Joining me tonight, the author of Borderline, Reflections on War, Sex, and the Church. Stephen Goff is an anti-war activist, a writer, a blogger. His prior activism, Goff had a long career in the armed forces, serving as the United States Army. I believe he was Special Forces. He's since then adopted the anti-imperialist, anti-feminist, social Marxist views, and he is now a Christian and active in putting out the word to stop the wars. His other previous books are, let's see, we've got Hideous Dream, The Full Spectrum, Disorder, The Military in the American Century.
Well, one of the things, like I was kind of looking at the website, it sort of mentioned my past as an activist and so forth, but this book is written, this is the first book I've written explicitly as a Christian. And I guess it's about the military, and it's about my military career. And that tends to be emphasized because I had a military career and because of the sort of heterodox positions I've taken since then. But another thing that's important to mention is that I was born in 1951. I'm a baby boomer. And someone at Cascade, my publisher, called the book a conceptual autobiography. And it has some autobiography, but between these autobiographical snapshots, there are a lot of longer passages on history and philosophy and theology and cultural criticism. So I hesitate to call it a conceptual autobiography because the concepts are secondary. People aren't formed by concepts, but we're formed by stories. And concepts are embedded in stories. And we all have stories. We have stories that our families tell about themselves, and we even have stories that our nation state tells about itself and so forth. You're listening to a radio programmer. You're watching television, you're taking in stories. Even the ads between the stories are stories. There's a main character that appears, and she's sad because she doesn't belong, because she's inadequate, because her smile's not bright enough. Then there's a turning point, and she encounters a special product, and it gives her a brighter smile or smoother skin or cures her constipation, and she's transformed from a sad person who doesn't belong into a happy person who's like dancing on the beach with their smiling, attractive friends. These are stories. They're manipulative stories, but these master manipulators in advertising and public relations know that the story is the way in. They know that we're formed by stories. They don't explain concepts. So Borderline is about stories, about the stories past and present that form me, and in that sense it's autobiographical. But it's from the perspective of my formation as a man, as a biological male, who's internalized stories about what men are supposed to be. And these are deeply political stories, because the stories we know about what man and woman are supposed to mean are stories about power, okay? And persons aren't formed by concept, they're formed by stories, and concepts are embedded in stories, you know. As a Christian, I'm trying to be formed by a story about love and nonviolence, and yet we see many, many people laying claim to this Jesus story. that's supposed to be at the center of our faith, and these people are callous, and they're hateful, and they're unforgiving, and they're violent. So this book is a genealogy of the stories that told me what it means to be a man, me being one white American male who did a military career in the latter half of the 20th century. And there's this terrible contradiction between this Christian story of compassion and vulnerability and these man stories about redemptive violence and conquest. And I believe that the church, this is the body of people claiming Jesus is God's incarnation, this church has been constantly pulled away from our story by a lot of different stories that were and still are hegemonic in our surrounding cultures. And these hegemonic stories change form to fit different times and places, but there are two fairly transhistorical constants that are closely related, and those are war and masculinity constructed as domination. And so my book is arguing, first, that war and conquest masculinity reproduce one another in a kind of recursive feedback loop. And the other thing I'm claiming is that the greatest sins of the church throughout its history can be traced to this dominator masculinity trumping this very gender-subversive story of compassion and vulnerability. And then finally, my book is arguing this conquest masculinity has always, always included women as one of its key objects of conquest. War, war culture, militarism are always, and I would say inevitably, misogynistic. So the church keeps falling for this counter-narrative from the surrounding society, this counter-narrative that loves war and hates women. So while it looks like I might be indicting my church in this book for going to war and for devaluing women, that indictment extends also to those cultures surrounding the church, because that's where I'm saying we're getting these counter-narratives. And that, in about 3 minutes, is as close as I can sum up the book without thoroughly confusing you and everybody that might be listening to this.
Yeah, it's in a sense confusing, but I get the picture of patriotism almost being used as a religion here in the United States and in all different cultures, to where patriotism is in some cases superseding people's religious ideologies and being more supremacistic against religion, in a sense, because people are following patriotism before they follow their religion, as to we're not supposed to kill, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not lie, but yet we're following patriotism more than a religion. And I'm guessing that's what you felt.
Well, yeah, and in fact, there's a significant part of the book that's devoted to sort of unpacking the origins of patriotism as a civil religion. In the United States, oddly enough, that you can actually locate that in history. This idea of a civic religion, this idea that, you know, that all soldiers are heroes and that war is the ultimate test of male virtue and all these things, these weren't very common at the beginning of this particular republic. They came to the fore during the American Civil War. This is when there really was a consolidation of something called a civil religion, and it's when patriotism and the civic religion came to trump people's other convictions of faith. One of the people who was very influential on me in the development of my own faith is a theologian named Stanley Hauerwas, and he said that American Christians are Americans before they're Christians. And that's exactly what he's referring to. They say, you know, we'll say, well, we're willing to kill or die for the country, but we're not willing to die for our faith. And it's whatever you're willing to kill or die for that's considered sacred. And it's other people, it's other theologians, William Kavanaugh, Amy Laura Hall, who wrote the foreword to the book, and other folks who cited the same thing, that we claim to be Christians and Americans at the same time, but in practice, our real religious commitment is to the nation. And the other is just sort of a sideshow. It's something, you know, that's very sort of personalized, but we don't invest a lot in it. This becomes a problem when people do practice their faith. And I believe if we practice the Christian faith in accordance with the Gospels, that means that we cannot participate in war. If all Christians tomorrow said that they would no longer participate in war, it would be quite a crisis for this country, I think. It's something to think about. Just imagine if all of a sudden Christians said, you know, we're not going to kill because it says we're not supposed to. You know, it says we're supposed to turn the other cheek. If we actually started to practice that, it would be a real crisis for the American nation state. And that's why a civic religion had to come to trump our other faith commitments in order to secure the power of the nation state.
Right. I fell for that patriotic thing when I was growing up, but I just don't see how national defense has become a national offense instead of what it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be defending ourselves here against enemies foreign and domestic, but there's no foreign enemies coming here, so I don't understand why we're going around the world fighting wars.
Yeah, that's kind of a that's kind of an interesting thing. We say, you know, that our soldiers are fighting for our freedom. I don't know anybody that's threatened our freedom anytime recently. The United States, I mean, just geographically speaking, the United States is an eminently defensible country. And I don't even argue for the right of self-defense. I mean, that's how much of a pacifist I am. But the thing is, you might have hit-and-run attacks like something that happened on 9/11, which was provoked by years and years of foreign policy. But the idea that anybody could militarily, an actual military threat to the United States as a policy is absurd. We're surrounded by two oceans. Unless somebody is expecting trouble from Canada, the logistics alone of conquering a country that's 3,000 by 2,000 miles, large with 300 million people and four guns in every household, is preposterous on its face. And so we have to invent things like a global war on terror to justify the kind of military spending that we do in this country, which is a very important economic activity. I mean, the Department of Defense in the United States serves as a surrogate export market because we have such a trade deficit with the rest of the world. And the reason that doesn't hurt us economically is because we spend so much money on military material.
Yeah, well, what I don't get is, people don't see that war in itself is terrorism on a bigger budget. So when they say global war on terrorism, maybe they are the global warring terrorist force, as far as I can see it, because it doesn't seem to be that, it's the people that are over there that are creating the terrorist movement. But I do see that we're terrorizing the hell out of a lot of nations. And I remember back in the late 80s, we were terrorizing the hell out of South America. So I guess now it's the Middle East and parts of Europe that we're going to try to terrorize for imperialistic domination. As far as I see it, what's your take on that?
Well, obviously, I kind of agree with that analysis as much as I understand it. The U.S. does export violence abroad, and does not have any. I don't think we have any authentic defense needs of the kind you're talking about, actually defending the homeland and that kind of thing. But I think everybody understands fairly well that to support the quote American way of life requires that we guarantee certain kinds of inputs from the rest of the world, in particular petroleum products, but other things as well. You know, strategic minerals and rare precious metals and things like that, just to support the way that we live right now. You know, this is accomplished on two fronts. It's accomplished on the economic front. You know, we've got the Trans-Pacific Partnership looming right now as one of the most egregious pieces of legislation that will ever be passed, and one that essentially violates the sovereignty not only of the United States but every other country that will be involved in it. So you have, you know, there are economic means to accomplish this. But when economic means are not sufficient to accomplish what we need to continue to support the way of life that we have right now, then force is the follow-up. That's not particularly new, and it's not particularly surprising. Every powerful nation in history, every nation that was imperial in the sense that it required inputs from peripheral countries or from colonies, is operated in essentially that way. They try to integrate the rest of their sphere of influence into themselves economically, and then they backed that up with force. So that's not a particularly new template, but the scale, the global scale of it is new, and the dangers that it presents are new. And we're seeing now, for the first time in history, that it's not just going to have global social ramifications, but we're seeing global ecological ramifications that are taking us into pretty uncharted territory. You know, we're talking about the loss of potable water for large parts of the earth, the destruction of topsoil, destabilization of a climate that's going to create problems that we absolutely cannot predict. So the scale makes it much more frightening in some ways than the same sort of template of power that's been in operation for several millennia. The thing about war that I try to emphasize in the book is a little bit different. And I've spoken about it in other books that I've written. I've talked about this sort of core periphery dynamic and how modern imperialism works, how neoliberalism works, and all that. But in this one, I really wanted to speak more to the moral composition of war, because we see, again, in stories about war, stories that glorify war, stories that glorify masculinity that's proven in war and that kind of thing, we see war as this sort of transcendent experience. In whatever way I can, I want to undo that idea. Because war is not like that, except in the movies, or except, you know, on whatever, late night TV. War is grubby. It's horrifying. It's the banality of evil. It's the day-to-day realities of war that make it. It doesn't read like a hero. It really reads like Ted Bundy on a mass scale. War does things to human beings, not just the people who are the victims of war, but the people who are the participants of war. It does things to us that dehumanize us. We dehumanize the people as soldiers that we're required to put our boot on. But at the same time, we strip ourselves of the capacity to care about other human beings. And in that sense, we also lose something. And in particular, when I say we, I mean men. Yes, there's a few women that participate in war, but war is still pretty much a male enterprise, and it's in terms of its glorification, it's always seen as a male enterprise. You know, and the exceptions being now, with liberal feminism, seeing the emancipation of women being the ability of women to behave like men, and I don't agree with that. If men are being brutal bastards, then that's not what women should aspire to. That's not any kind of equality that we want to aspire to. But war is something that damages everybody that gets involved in it, but it damages men. And it also gives men the conceptual coordinates for all the other activities in their lives in which we shut ourselves off from the capacity for vulnerability, the capacity for intimacy, the capacity for love. And I think that's a terrible loss in someone's life, especially as someone who professes a faith where we say that God's self is love. We're cutting ourselves off from God. That's my conviction.
You're absolutely correct on that. And I believe that the certain group brought this liberalism and feminism and extremism to the nation for the sole intention of profiteering from behind it with the militarized industrial complex. Now, we were stating earlier that you were in South America during the 80s and everything else. I know you've probably seen a lot of things that legally you probably can't speak about, but being that you were special forces, we know that there was a lot of things that were going on that the American public knew nothing about and still don't know nothing about that went on in South America as far as pushing our power and our weight around on them. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I think everybody knows that anything that a public official says is not said to represent reality. If it represents reality, that is incidental. It's always meant to manage perception. I could say that when I was working as an advisor in Colombia and when I was working as an advisor in Peru, the American public was told that we were doing counter-narcotics training. I was never even shown a picture of what a drug lab looks like. It just simply wasn't true. We were training counterinsurgency. And counterinsurgency training was used by those militaries against their own people.
Right.
You know, so it was basically in deployments to eight conflict areas during the course of my career, in every single case I was involved in some way or another in a war against poor people. And in a war on behalf of the interests of rich people. And I think that pretty well sums up what I learned about my own participation as an instrument of American foreign policy. It's about, at the end of the day, it's about money and power. You know, it's always about money and power. Now, it can be it can be about other things for the time being, but the strategic vision in the long term that drives what we do is about preserving someone's power. But, you know, again, like I say, this book wasn't so much about foreign policy, because, again, I've sort of addressed this stuff in other books. I really wanted to talk about the moral aspect of this. And you're talking about Latin America. Like, I was in El Salvador in the 1980s. In fact, I was there in 1985, at the same time that Inés Guadalupe Duarte was kidnapped, the president's daughter was kidnapped. There had been a murder of a bunch of people, including some Marines, in San Salvador in a place called Zona Rosa. I was staying in a place that was right next to Zona Rosa, a block and a half away while I was there, and I watched a beggar out there one day, He had no legs. He was a legless beggar. He was making his way through Zona Rosa. This was a well-to-do commercial district in San Salvador, and it's lined with chic shops and restaurants the vast majority of Salvadorans could never afford. And the well-dressed young ricos, you know, the rich kids, they walked right past this legless beggar with not even a tick in their conversation. And I realized that for all practical purposes, this man was invisible. Now, he was there, flesh and blood. He was advancing down the sidewalk on wooden blocks that were held in his hands and, you know, past the spat-out gum and the wind-blown trash and the cigarette butts and the dog shit. And this striking image was just sort of magically abracadabra'd into non-existence by this cultural sleight of mind that cloaked these rich kids' power in the same move that made this man invisible. I'm sorry, I realized that I just used the word. I'm not sure if that's permissible on the radio. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. Go ahead.
In the book I wrote about that, and then I followed up with talking about, I don't know if you remember a film some years back called Dirty Pretty Things, but it's about undocumented foreigners who are, they live underground in London, they get entangled in the trade in human transplant organs, and there's this Nigerian fugitive, he's named Okwai, and he's asked during the third act in this film by this wealthy English organ purchaser that pulls up in this nice car. He says, who were he, you know, and his two women companions? One of them was an English prostitute, and the other was a sexually exploited Turkish hotel singer. And Okwai replies, you know, very sardonically, he said, and again, watch out, I'm about to say a bad word here. He said, we're the people that you don't see. He's invisible, see? We're the people you don't see. We drive your cabs and clean your rooms and suck your cock. This is a film about social invisibility in a society that's driven by the very opposite of Christ's compassion. You know?
Right.
And Walter Brueggemann, a Protestant theologian, wrote that about compassion, about this word compassion. We think it's just sentimentality, but he said, you know, this is a quote from Walter Brueggemann. He says, compassion constitutes a radical form of criticism. This is why Jesus was crucified. Compassion constitutes a radical form of criticism, for it announces that the hurt is to be taken seriously, that the hurt is not to be accepted as normal and natural, but is an abnormal and unacceptable condition of humanness. Compassion actually ends up...
Let me help you off right there so we can take a quick break, and we'll come back right in a couple of minutes after this quick break here on the BBS Radio Network with my guest, Stan Goff. We'll be right back.
Okay.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to The People Speak. This is Rod Cash with our guest, Stan Goff, here on the BBS Radio Network. Stan, let's go back to where you left off about the power structure and everything else. But just before that, I want to know what your sentiment is about 9/11, because I know a lot of my audience that participate is probably dying to hear what your sentiments on the 9/11 situation and what you think of it.
Well, I don't subscribe to the conspiracy theory that the United States government did it. So I have a lot of other thoughts about it, about the way, you know, the reaction of the United States to it and all that. But I don't particularly subscribe to any conspiracy theory about how it happened. I think it was Osama bin Laden said that he planned it. I believe he did. And if he did, as a strategic offensive operation, it was probably one of the most effective in human history, because it managed to pull the United States into two unwinnable wars that have gone on for a decade and a half right now. And we spent trillions and trillions of dollars and lost all kinds of treasure and people. And it's torn the country apart at times. I mean, in terms of how it's functioned as an attack on the United States as a political entity, it's like I say, it's probably one of the most effective strategic offensive operations in human history.
Well, yeah, I don't subscribe to the whole thing that I don't think that Osama bin Laden was able to do it. He was a very ill man, or that he planned it or anything of that sort. Because as I've spoken to people in other interviews, Muhammad Atta was supposedly a million mile flyer. So you don't get a million miles of flight time if you're just an average person sitting in a cave as a terrorist.
The 9/11 thing is just not my thing.
Right. Okay.
The book I've written is about gender and war.
Okay, good. Well, let's move on to other things like self-sustainability. Do you think that's important for people to start learning how to self-sustain, grow their own gardens and, grow their own food or have their own animals, things of that sort? For the near future?
Well, for different reasons for different people. I'm not a survivalist. I believe in community self-sufficiency. And by that I mean systematic, long-term, gradual relocalization, because it interrupts a lot of the social problems that we see with economies that are on an extremely large scale and economies that are dependent on very distant inputs. I can go to my grocery store and buy cherries that were grown in Chile. Why should I be buying cherries grown in Chile when I live in Michigan? We grow plenty of cherries right here. The difference is I can get them when they're out of season, you see. But to become dependent on inputs like that means that we become dependent on a huge transportation grid and all that. I'm actually involved with the Adrian Dominican Sisters in a pretty substantial permaculture project. But again, it's not oriented toward, let's see if we can survive the apocalypse, because I don't believe that that's the way that history's going to pan out. I think societies rise and collapse in gradual steps, and that people adapt to those steps as they go along. But I believe that the problems that we're going to see with various peak resources and with climate change and with the insustainability of the economic system that we have right now, that we're going to be forced into relocalization by and by, but we need to learn how to do it as early as possible in order to achieve a softer landing for people in the long term. But it's about the community. It's not about, you know, my family and I are going to go get, you know, a cabin in the woods and hole up with our guns and ammunition and wait for the apocalypse. There are some people who support these ideas of sustainability out of that sense. My interest in permaculture, my interest in sustainable systems of habitation, waste management, water management, food production, and so forth, has to do with peacemaking. A monetized economy, a monetized capitalist economy like the one we have right now, is based on enforced scarcity. Everybody depends on money. Money is the single thing that everybody has to have to some extent. And that is an enforced dependency, but it's one that's so completely integrated into the system that none of us can completely get away from it. But then that money is made scarce. It's made scarce by inequality. It's made scarce by the way that money works in an economy that's based on something called growth, which is a euphemism for profit, and the progressive commodification of everything. But nature's economy is different, and the vernacular economies prior to the Industrial Revolution were subject to crises and things like earthquakes or famines or things like that. But for the most part, people had more than enough most of the times until these catastrophes hit. And now we have ways to insulate ourselves from those catastrophes. But if you have an economy, a relocalized economy of abundance, where there's enough for people to share, then you don't have as much conflict. If you have an economy based on scarcity, scarcity creates conflict. And when I study things like permaculture or practice constructing permaculture systems or other system, biodynamic systems, and work with other members of my community on greater community relocalization and self-sufficiency, what we're doing is aiming toward economies of abundance. And my interest in that is my interest in peacemaking. Economies of abundance do not create conflict. Economies of scarcity do create conflict.
Absolutely correct. I believe this is how they were able to infiltrate and take over, you know, the power structure, not just here in the United States, but all over the world, because they've got people on the easy trend. Well, if you need meat, go to the market. If you need this, go buy it at the market. If you need clothes, go buy it at the market. People have forgotten self-sustainability and wouldn't know how to survive. So it's more of a sense of a power tool against humanity for these people that don't know how to say hunt and forage and grow their own food and be able to sustain themselves. But also I agree with you that it does bring people closer together as far as sharing, as far as community coming together in a whole as a family. They can't be divided because they're all working together for the same entity, and that's to sustain their own personal lives within that community. Yeah. Which is great idea. Great idea. I love it. Well, anything else you would like to add? What are your sentiments about what's going on right now with ISIS and everything that's going on in the Middle East? Is that just another push and pull like South America was? Just to gain...
Well, no, I think the situation in the Middle East, particularly in Iraq and Syria right now, it's a situation that was created by the destabilization of Iraq and an American invasion and occupation. It, very few people even disagree with that. Even the people who sort of support U.S. militarism realize that the Bush administration's invasion and occupation of Iraq led directly, almost in a straight line, to the development of ISIS, because it destabilized the one. It's true, it was a brutal regime in some respects, but I mean, it was a regime that was stable. And when they destabilized it, they left. They created a vacuum in a lot of places, and that vacuum was filled. And it was, in fact, it was filled by the very people, you know, during the surge that was led by David Petraeus, one of the most overrated military leaders in history. They armed these Shia militias to viciously attack the Sunni population, and they've still reacted against that, and that's been the biggest recruiting tool that someone like ISIS has had. Now, what's my feeling about what the United States' involvement in that should be? None. We should come home. The United States has no need for a standing military. I really believe that. I don't believe we should have a single base outside the United States. I don't believe we should have a single base outside the United States, nor should we involve ourselves in any kind of military action anywhere in the world, ever. And that's, I think that's a doable policy. That doesn't mean that I would support a bunch of armed men even inside the United States, because again, what I'm writing about in this book is not just about what's going on in the world right now as everybody perceives it. I want people to start to understand this stuff through the lens of gender. I want them to start understanding that you can see all this stuff through the lens of a masculinity constructed as conquest and domination. That's what the book is about. The book is about masculinity constructed as conquest and domination, and how that even informs not just the people who are running the Imperium right now. When I was active on the left in politics, I saw that same sort of conquest machismo, and in fact, I was guilty of it myself, but it was out there on the left, too. There's always this idea that what's going to redeem the situation is violence, and that's a male fantasy. That's a male fantasy. It's the same kind of male fantasy that, you know, a lot of apocalypticists have, you know, about, well, we're going to go out and form guerrilla bands and all this. This is all male fantasy. And we get those fantasies, again, from stories. And we're inundated with these stories. Every film we see shows everything. I mean, I remember this all the way. Again, I was born in 1951. So I think I was 4 or 5 years old when we got our first black and white television set. And what comes on, it's the Lone Ranger. And then the Disney shows with the Swamp Fox and the Gray Ghost and all this stuff. And it was always, there's a bad situation out there. And the Western was the great genre back then. But there's always a situation that you see. And this is the story that we try to live into as men. There's a situation that's out there that's unjust. There's injustice out there. There's something that's wrong. And the way it gets resolved, the way the situation is redeemed, is through male violence. So right. We see violence as a redemptive force. And that's not a universal trope in our culture. That's a masculine trope. That's a male trope. That fantasy is not a female fantasy. It's a male's fantasy. We're indoctrinated into that idea almost from birth. In all the ways the gender is indoctrinated. Masculinity is socially constructed. There's a story in the book, and this is about Lisa Scher and Michael Sapolsky were actually researching stress, the physiological effects of stress, but they were doing it by studying baboons. And they were studying this troop of baboons, they called it forest troop, for several years. And Sapolsky remarked one time, he said, you know, I don't really like baboons because they were mean. They were just meaner than hell. They were the biggest males dominated everybody and beat on them, and then everybody that was getting beat on started beating on somebody who was smaller than them, and they were stressed out all the time, so it gave them an opportunity to study the physiological effects of stress. But what they found out was they found baboons to be very just mean creatures. Well, because the male baboons, the dominant male baboons, had the first crack at anything that was good to eat, they got into a camp, a human camp, where there was some meat that was left out that was infected with bovine tuberculosis. And the dominant males, of course, ate all the meat, and then they all died. Well, Sapolsky and Scher came back the next year to see forest troop. And lo and behold, the troop had become very pacific. They'd become calm after the die-off of these brutal, dominant males. The whole troop had become nicer, and there were males that had came in. Adolescent males migrate into the troop from adjacent troops. They have whatever the baboon version is of an incest taboo, but they migrated in, and even a generation after the die-off of the dominant males, this culture had become more peaceable. What's interesting about that to me is that we have a lot of people who try to use primate studies to prove that things like masculinity and femininity are hardwired, that they're somehow hormonal and inevitable and from nature as opposed to culture. There's that nature culture dichotomy. But it turns out that baboons as a primate were very cultural. They were just like us. They were, to a large extent, formed by their culture. And lo and behold, when they eliminated this cadre of violent males, their whole culture became more peaceable. I thought that was really, really interesting. Not just from the gender perspective, but from the perspective of people trying to build this false dichotomy of between nature and nurture and why men are the way that men are. Men are the way that men are because we are trained that that's the way that men are supposed to be. And again, I think one of the things for human beings, especially because we're so symbolic in the way that we think, that the most formative influences on us in terms of what we want to call our concepts and our thinking are really that we're trying to live into particular kinds of stories. Well, nowadays, we're hit with story after story after story, and you think about it, just turn on a television set or go look and see what's on at the theater right now and how many of these stories that we're assimilating are about male violence as a redemptive force.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I gave up on the movies and the television sets a long, long time ago. I stopped watching them because I thought it was perversing the human mind in so many different ways to the point of disbelief. I've seen the conditioning of the boob tube, as you want to call it, and the push of homosexuality on men. I don't know if that's trying to make men peaceable, but I'm totally against that. Go ahead.
I missed what you just said about homosexuality.
Uh-huh.
I didn't understand what you said.
I was saying homosexuality is being forced down the throats of America with all this...
Beyond that, how do you force a sexual orientation on anyone?
By glorifying it.
By glorifying it? Or by allowing the people who are gay are... just as deserving of human dignity and respect as everyone else. That's not glorifying it. That's just saying, let's treat everybody the same.
Well, in a sense, yes, and in a sense, no. I mean, do I want my children to be subjected to men kissing each other on television? I mean, don't get me wrong. I have nothing against homosexuality, but I just don't want it to be in my face against my will. I'm not taking my sexual life out into their home, so why would I want them to bring their sexual life into my home? This is
married?
The way I see things.
Are you married?
No, I'm not.
All right, do you have a girlfriend?
Yes.
Do you ever kiss her in public?
No.
You don't? I kiss my wife in public all the time.
Well, that's great. Great for you.
I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on this. I think homophobia is one of those things, again, the strong reaction that people have against same-sex partnerships are a reaction that's closely associated to our ideas that men are supposed to be one way and women are supposed to be another way, and part of that is they're supposed to be heteronormative. Men are only supposed to be attracted to women, and women are only supposed to be attracted to men. But we know that's not the case. You know, there's a number of people for whom, whatever reason, that's just not the way they are. And the way that we've treated sexual minorities in the past and in the present has been barbaric. It's been barbaric. And, you know, when we say, you shouldn't be allowed to kiss your partner in public, then I think the same thing should apply to us. You know?
I agree.
You can't indoctrinate somebody into a sexual orientation. You're not going to take a heterosexual adolescent and turn them into a homosexual by exposing them to somebody who's in a same-sex relationship.
Well,
one of my siblings is gay, and she has three very heteronormative children. And I've seen this over and over again. Moreover, I have seen same-sex partnerships that were more principled, more sharing, more mutual, more loving, and more considerate than many heteronormative relations. And I think those should be the criteria by which we judge the relationship between two people, whether there's a sexual component or not. Not whether who's going to rub what with whom whenever they're in the bedroom. I disagree that there's some sort of a problem with that. And I think that our homophobia grows directly out of our ideas about masculinity and femininity, about this idea that there's some sort of an inscribed by nature complementarity between male and female, and it's always an unequal complementarity.
Well, I'm guessing that for me it's more of a cultural thing, because I'm from the Middle East, and this is just something we don't do in the Middle East. We don't kiss in public. We don't do things of that nature. So,
really?
Yeah.
When I was in Jordan, men kissed each other all the time. When they greeted each other, it was 1, 2, 3, a peck on the cheek for every set of friends that I saw did as soldiers. Jordanian soldiers.
As far as the greeting is concerned, but for male and female to be French kissing out in the middle of the streets and the roads is far fetched. It's hardly seen. It's always done in private and out of public view.
As far as the
kissing on the cheeks and everything, that goes on in a few different cultures, not just the Arabs, but also the French. So.
Oh, yeah. And Russians. Russians kiss each other dead on the mouth. And early Christians do, too, as a matter of fact. The early Christian liturgy, the early Christians, this is the first 200 years of the church. Mm-hmm. Spirit, the word for spirit and the word for breath is the same thing. In fact, still, if you talk about inspire, expire, and respiration, because breath was associated with life and spirit. The early Christians ate kiss. That's what they did. They had it was called the conspiracy, the with spirit, with one another spirit. And they would gather together in a house. They would worship. They would share a meal, which is the beginning of the Eucharist. And then they would greet one another with a kiss right on the mouth. Everybody would eat because it was an exchange of the spirit.
Okay.
Now, it's been sexualized in modern times because we've sexualized everything. But I have to tell you, unless I'm going to a bar or someplace, and I don't go there anymore because I quit drinking, I'm sitting, in this town that I live in right here, and I can't, I've been in this town for 4 years. I don't think I've ever seen anybody French kiss in the street.
Well, there you go. We're gonna have to leave it at that, Stan. We'll bring you back another time, and we'll discuss this a little bit more. But I am out of time, and I do have to call it a night. I'd like to thank my audience for joining us here on The People Speak, where our media here is not the mainstream media. We try to get as much of the truth out to people, and this is what we're all about. So this is Rock Cash checking out for this evening. Have a good week, everyone. We'll see you next week.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.